Blog Talk Radio.
The following program is brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE.
Hi, my name's John Carosella, and I'm your host for Convergence on Firefly Willows LIVE. Convergence is to consciousness as gravity is to the material world. In small amounts, gravity is overwhelmed by every other fundamental force of the universe. But gravity has something nothing else has. It's cumulative. The more matter you collect, the more gravity you get, until it becomes the most powerful force of the material world. I think convergence is like that too. Only in this case, we're working with truth. The more truth we collect, the more convergence we experience. Connections, relationships, resonance of ideas and concepts, science and mysticism. Lately, deep truths just seem to be coming together, even as many of the illusions around us are falling apart. As within, so without. As above, so below. I know I'm feeling it, and I'll bet you are too. For the next 90 minutes, we'll be exploring concepts and topics that in some way or another bring us around to a deeper truth. Join me and my guests for this week's experience of Convergence.
Hello and welcome. I'm John Carosella. This month, join me for a special issue of Convergence. We're highlighting some of the very special guests and contributions we've enjoyed over the past 15 months. I've selected topics that remind us of the divine nature of ourselves and of our surroundings, and how we might walk beautifully in this kind of universe. First, a poem. This poem is unattributed, but I found it in the Book of Runes by Ralph Blum. God within me, God without. How shall I ever be in doubt? There is no place where I may go, and not there see God's face, not know I am God's vision and God's ears. So through the harvest of my years, I am the sower and the sown, God's self unfolding and God's own. Next up, a new Firefly Willows Roundtable, in which I ask the question, are you God?
Welcome, everyone, to our Firefly Willows LIVE Roundtable. I'm John Carosella, together with my co-hosts, Deb Carosella.
Good morning.
Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Oh.
And Heisi Lutmers.
Hello.
And today's topic is just something maybe a little challenging, maybe just plumb obvious. And it starts with this. I had the opportunity to see Matt Kahn, who's kind of a non-dualist teacher down in Santa Cruz. And at the end of the conversation, or at the end of his
presentation,
thank you, I asked him the question about the nature of the divine in the self. You know, if you really are God, right, if God is really expressing him or herself through you, where does God stop and you start? And if that's true, why are we imperfect? And all those kinds of questions. And Matt said something that I thought was intriguing. He said, just erase the line. Practice erasing the line between yourself and the divine that is coming through you. And it's been an interesting practice over the last 2 months or so for me to be playing around with that. So I thought I'd ask the question. Are you divine? What does it mean to be divine? Is God expressing himself or herself through you at this very moment? What's the difference between you and the divine? And where does the divine stop and the humbler earthbound you begin? how do you bring more of the divine through? And what happens when you do? Anybody have some thoughts that they'd like to share on that?
Yes, John, Stoltz, and I have some thoughts.
Please.
So the first thing I did, I think this is a great topic, is I looked up the definition of divine, to see if I could relate to it. And according to the dictionary, divine means of or relating to, emanating from, or being an expression of a deity. So your first question, am I divine? I would give a resounding absolute yes, and for many reasons.
And
I'm kidding. But in terms of your question, am I divine? Definitely yes. And then your second question, what does it mean to be divine? And I sat with this one a little while, and I came up with the being part of me is divine. It's the eternal part. And it's because it's immortal. There's no beginning. There's no end. So, and then your other question, am I an expression of the divine? And I believe I am at this very moment. And is there a difference between myself and the divine? I don't believe there is. And then your other question about the divine, where the divine stops and the human part starts. To go back to your initial phrase that you used, there's no line for me. I don't see a difference. It seems to be a continuum. And I can't remember your next question.
Well, the idea was, how do you bring, or the last part was, how do you bring more of the divine through, and what happens when you do?
Well, I don't really know if it's possible to bring more of the divine through if you're already divine.
So the idea that that as divine beings, we're emanating the, you know, God consciousness into this reality. How does that square with our limitations and weaknesses and flaws and things like that for you?
I don't view them as limitations, weaknesses, and flaws. I view it as we're here to experience the joy of being alive, and it's a part of it because we're in a duality. So it's amazing how you can look at your life if you choose not to look at things as weaknesses or flaws, but experiences to be corrected, necessary, but just experiences.
So it's all good.
For me, it's all good.
Okay. Well, that's pretty. That sums it up pretty well. I like that. Hi-C, how about you?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is I would go back to what the person you were talking to said about erasing the line, because I, like Mildred as well, don't think that there is a line, but we get too fixated on almost needing the separation. But maybe that comes from our societal imprinting that somehow we have been separated from the divine, or from certain traditions, they would say from God, or that we're somehow, there's a distance between, and I don't see that. I tend to think of it more like, if you think of the divine as the ocean, how do you see or define the separation of each drop of water in the ocean from the ocean itself? And so I don't think that you can, and that each of us are like drops in the divine, and the divine is just the bigger fabric or the bigger ocean. And therefore there isn't really a difference or a separation. Our human body has just become a container, like dipping a cup into the water. You know, our human body is just a container that's holding a drop or a particular portion of that divinity. But there's also a porousness. So it's not like it's separated from it. It's just that it has a container that's holding it, but it can move through that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you, when you ask about how do we reconcile, when we think of divinity as perfection, and how do we reconcile not being perfect in whatever way that means, But I think that, you know, divinity and the gods are always evolving. So if the gods are always evolving, then I would say that our experience, because this is just an experience in a particular plane of existence, but all the different planes and dimensions are happening at the same time. And this is just part of the evolution process. This is just a part of the experiencing and the learning process that helps with the evolution of the divine, because we are a part of the divine. Therefore, whatever we go through is part of that growing and changing and shifting and evolving and all of that. And that's why I tend to think if we can see everything as well as make every act sacred, then we are both honoring that divinity within us as well as contributing to the continuation and perpetuation of that divinity. And whether that's wiping down the counter or doing an elaborate ritual that is designed to bring us into greater union with the greater ocean of divinity. Anything from those two points and in between, if we can make everything and see everything and assume everything is sacred, then we will realize and connect with both divinity as well as seeing that we're not any different or separate from that divinity.
Interesting. And Deb, your thoughts?
I think that I'm probably more aware of the line than Heisi or Mildred has expressed. I believe that we are all divine and that we are all part of the greater ocean, as Heisi put it. I think that that's very true. I totally believe that. I just have a greater sense of the individual drops and myself being a very specific individual drop within that greater space. So for me, the expression of the divine, probably I find it or I feel it most when I'm in joy, when I'm happy, when I'm totally joyful, when I see something beautiful, when I find spontaneous laughter, something of that nature. And that, for me, that helps erase that line that I sense within myself. But I pretty much feel the earthbound separateness from the divine, I think, as a real thing. And those things are, I'm not quite ready or able to view the trials, the tribulations, the ups and downs as experiences and equate them with the same open-heartedness as I find the experiences of joy. I'm still ready to be ticked off when I run into obstacles and things like that, and to, in a way, fight them, overcome them. I hopefully learn from them. But I'm not as open to simply accepting that that's just a part of what needs to be, and that it's all one.
Yeah. So what about you guys? Heisi and Mildred Lynn, when you get to those hard places, in the Celtic Wheel of the North, the rocky places of our experience, and you find that your reactions are more human than divine, how do you resolve the notion of it all being that you're the deity experiencing that versus the human struggling through that?
Well, for me, John, when I'm experiencing something that's distasteful for myself, where I offend my sensibilities, I let myself be in the moment and experience whatever I'm going to experience. The divine part happens afterwards upon reflection. When I step back and I say, oh, now that that's over, what do I choose to make it mean? What's that all about? And that's, for me, the place where the being part of the divine part comes into action, because it provides perspective. And for myself, perspective isn't one lifetime. It's over a number of lifetimes. And you'd be amazed, if you use that framework, how small whatever you're dealing with is in the larger context of being.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
That's how I move through it.
All right. So in the moment, you are experiencing it just because you're in a human vessel.
I'm just as cranky as the next person.
And we can validate that, ladies and gentlemen.
It doesn't happen often, but.
I have a little motto, John. It's the last person I want to fight with is myself. Yeah, so that helps me through. So.
I see. How about you? When it's in those rocky places, your humanity is there. The difficulty of being human is there. Yeah.
Yes, but you know, first for me it was, I don't see deity as judgmental or punishing. So therefore, I don't start to think that I have failed or done something wrong, or even that I have to live up to something. But the first step for me is, if we cultivate awareness of our own divinity, then we become, or then we generate a greater awareness on a conscious level of when we might be moving towards acting or reacting in that way that you're talking about. And that awareness can allow us to then stop it and shift it in order to act or respond in a different way. But it's that cultivation of awareness and then an acceptance of divinity within us that leads to the ability to be aware of when we are moving towards acting in that way or reacting in that way, so that we can start to change it. And because if divinity is always evolving and learning and growing and shifting and changing, then it really negates the idea that a lot of people cling to when they do something, say something, act or react in a certain way. And if somebody calls them on it, a lot of times what you hear people say is, well, that's just how I am. And that indicates that there is an entrenched belief on that person's part that they simply are the way they are and that can't change, which shows that there isn't an awareness of that growth and evolution that is happening, not just can happen, but is happening whether they like it or not. And it's just a matter of whether they want to step into and be a part of consciously that process, or they want to just feel as if they're being buffeted about throughout life, subjected to outside forces and things, rather than seeing that they're actually a part of that.
Mm. Okay. So what happens when you, this is a question to all of us, what happens when you do more of the divine presence thing? What shifts in your life?
Well, for me, particularly since I, at the moment, equate the divine with joy, it's a much better place to be in. It's the sense of wholeness and completeness is much greater in joy than it is in other ways of being.
Mildred Lynn, I see.
For me, nothing, because I embrace the human experience. And to me, the spiritual experience is no more important than the human, because that's how my soul chose to show up. My being chose to show up. So I really honor that. Mm. So I don't look at the human part as less than.
Mm.
It's an experience vehicle. Zoom, zoom.
I don't differentiate. I don't think there's a difference between the human and the spiritual experience. It's all the same experience, but people always are separating that out. And so then they can't, they lose sight of the spiritual experience in something that they probably are seeing as very human. But then they also sometimes can get lost in the spiritual and can forget how to make the spiritual experience human, or at least have it or express it on a human level.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of what we're talking about here, I'm sure there's people listening and they're thinking, well, you know, it's all fine and good to talk about this kind of thing in these kind of highfalutin ways. But, you know, how does that help me when I'm, you know, starving on the street, or
yeah, when I'm suffering,
being mugged in the alleyway, or, you know, whatever. But I don't necessarily have an answer at this moment.
But it should help.
Well, I kind of think that, you know, for me, the idea of erasing the line is a new one. And allowing my perception of my highest self and my perception of what God is all about and what the divine is to be, the pivot point, so to speak, the locus of my attention and the place from which I act. The more I allow that to happen, the more I encourage that to happen, the less the pain becomes suffering when I'm in those hard places. And the more, the opportunity that I experience in my life becomes something that is, that's communal, right? It's more shared to me, right? I think I see myself as less selfish and less isolated, and more supported and more supporting of the world around me. So I'm working on it, and I encourage all of us out there to do the same. So, all right. Well, thank you very much to my magnificent co-hosts. Stay tuned for the rest of the show. We have a special show for you this month. It's a recap of some of the highlights over the past, actually since we started Convergence back in April of 2012. So stay tuned, and thanks very much, guys.
You're welcome.
Thanks, John.
We'll be right back.
At Firefly Willows, LIVE, we're working hard to be your trusted source for fun, enlightening, and heart-centered information and community. And we're passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected, media-rich world. If you're passionate about facilitating change and you have gifts or ideas you'd like to share, come join us, host a show, or be a guest, or connect us to an amazing speaker or teacher whose message is too good to miss. There's always room for courageous, knowledgeable change makers, inspired artists, and new ideas. Let us know you're interested. Send an email to info@fireflywillows.com. We're Firefly Willows, LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella. Next, one of my Exploring Reality segments, in which Tucker, my beautiful, soulful, big black dog, presents me with a powerful lesson. I guess it was a pretty typical evening around here. I'd been meditating, doing some deep journey work, contemplating the nature of God and the divine. I was contemplating the limits of my own awareness and what connection I had with God and what connection God had with me and through me into the world. I was asking questions like, how much of me was my higher self? What was the nature of my higher self anyway? And what was the difference between my higher self and God? Was there separation? There must be, because my higher self has a lot of my personality in it, minus my dysfunctions, I figure. And God was, well, more than that. I took a break. I came in from the fire to refresh myself with a little something. And as I grabbed that little something out of the fridge, our trusty family dog, always on alert for an important mission, was at my feet. Of course. I looked down at him, smiled, and said, "No, Tucker, this is not for doggies."
This is for Daddy. And as usual, he looked up at me with friendly mischief in his eyes, trying to convince me to change my mind. But this time, something miraculous happened. This time I saw something I had never seen before, and it brought a whole bunch of things suddenly into focus. I saw Tucker not as a dog, but as divine consciousness, experiencing reality through a dog's body, through a dog's equipment, so to speak. Just as I was God, experiencing reality through my equipment, my body, my fears and dysfunctions and habits and patterns, Tucker was divine consciousness too, trying to express itself and experience itself. This moment, this realization was not an abstraction. It was very real and visceral and grounded and present. I was catapulted back to a common activity that Tucker and I share. We have a beautiful, bountiful orange tree in our backyard. From the time Tucker was a youngster, I would go pluck myself an orange, sit down on a lawn chair, peel it, and eat it. And of course, as often as not, Tucker was there with me. And being a dog, he would nose his way into the action. One for you, one for me. Back and forth with each slice of the orange. After a while, I would tire, or just be full of oranges, but Tucker never seemed quite satisfied. Eventually, I would pluck an orange and break it in half, or just crack the peel, and leave the whole thing for him as I went inside and pursued other human antics. Tucker loves oranges. Eventually, he would learn to pluck the oranges from the tree himself. But there was always something subtly different about sitting together. He enjoyed picking his own fruit and eating it. He enjoyed the fruit if I picked it and peeled it and gave the whole thing to him. But there was nothing he enjoyed more. Nothing, honestly, that he enjoys more than one for you and one for me. Suddenly, it all made sense. He's not a dog looking for food. He's divine consciousness looking for a shared experience. What is the purpose of God in creation? It's been theorized that it's all about God having the opportunity to experience himself in and through the infinite diversity of the creation. So there he was, peeking out at me through Tucker's eyes. And when I greeted him that way, there was a smile of recognition and almost a sigh of relief, as if he had been waiting a very long time for me to see him and greet him and share with him in that way. When I abstract myself upwards from the mundane, profane experience of every day, I realize that there's a great force of consciousness that is squeezed perilously and imperfectly through my small and limited physical self. And there are great swaths of it that I glimpse only erratically and imperfectly, and often that I won't let through. Things like forgiveness and charity and joy. What gets in the way are things like immaturity, petulance, and self-righteousness, and fear, mostly fear. And looking at Tucker, I saw that there could be no fear. There could be just the differences between us, between our instrumentation, so to speak, and the delight in experiencing the same thing, a slice of orange, through these different instruments, and trying to share what that's like with each other, simply by being together and enjoying the experience together. Then what unfolded for me was a greater landscape of the divine. Everything around me became the divine, became divine consciousness experiencing. The orange tree was divine consciousness experiencing the creation through the instrument of an orange tree. The empty wine bottle became divine consciousness experiencing what it was like to be a wine bottle, formed from sand, assessed for purity and clarity and reliability, and filled with an elixir to be enjoyed, but patiently waiting to be tapped, to be called upon to pour out libations. And I stepped back in horror
at my own now foolish inability to recognize the divine in the wine bottle. The Lakota people talk about the grandfathers that are the rocks that they put in the fire for the sweat lodge. They say that the stone people are among the wisest because they have great knowledge, great wisdom. I considered suddenly how this observation might be true. A rock has been the divine experiencing reality for a very, very long time. It has the lens, the experience of a geologic age, and yet a presence in this reality, on this planet. How much can a rock experience? I don't know. But I realized that the ever-increasing expression of life, the increasing complexity of life on this planet, might be God's way of adapting, growing, and getting more stimulation from his experiment. I realize that's probably why God is such a fan of sexual reproduction. All that mixing and experiencing from all those new and ever so slightly different perspectives. All of the pollen mixing in the air from all the trees and all the flowers. And all of the antics of all the animals, courting and mating and having young. And apart from reproduction, I realize that's probably why sex feels so amazing for us humans. There's something about the mingling of experience, the sharing of experience, that reaches some kind of pinnacle in sex. And great sex leads us further out into that rarefied territory. How do we experience the divine in our lives? It suddenly became a lot easier when I realized that everything around me is the divine trying to experience me. We're not alone. Far from it. We're all in this together. We're all a slice of the divine consciousness in this soup of togetherness so that we can come to know it and in the process come to know ourselves. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm John Carosella. Last June 2012, Tom Cowan was on the program. Tom is the author of Fire in the Head and was my teacher for my two-year program in Celtic Shamanism. We talked a lot in our conversation about the concept of sovereignty.
Well, I think understanding the substance of sovereignty is, first of all, it's really important. And second of all, there's a lot of subtlety in this that isn't illuminated on first pass.
No, it's not.
And I think it has a lot to do with the divine feminine and sustainability and non-duality. I mean, there's a lot in there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, yeah. So if could you tell a story about, I think it's Sir Gawain.
Mm-hmm.
And his encounter.
It's the story of Dame Ragnell. Is that the one you're thinking of?
Yeah, they're out and they meet this woman who insists that somebody has to marry her.
The story, it backs up a little bit that Arthur one day is out, you know, riding through the forest. And there are different versions of the story, but he ends up being challenged by this green knight. And they have a sword fight and they fight all day long. And the green knight wins and he's ready to take off Arthur's head. And Arthur pleads for mercy, and the Green Knight says, I'll let you live, but I'm going to give you a riddle. And if you can solve the riddle in a year and a day, come back, tell me the answer, and I won't take off your head. If you don't have the right answer, then I will chop off your head. So Arthur says, okay, but what's the riddle? And the Green Knight says, it's a question. What does a woman want most in all the world? And Arthur thinks, oh, boy, this is going to be a toughie. But he goes back to Camelot, and his nephew, Sir Gawain, says, well, I'll help you. And so for a whole year, they ride through the realm and they ask all kinds of women, what is it a woman wants most in all the world? And they hear lots of different answers. Some say they want beauty, some want money, some want a good husband or a good lover, healthy children, long life. But Arthur and Gawain know that really none of these is the answer that the Green Knight's looking for. So a year and a day go by, and they have a bunch of answers, but they don't think any of them is the correct one. But being honorable men, they go back to that clearing in the woods where the Green Knight is for the rendezvous with them. And as they're going, they come across a hideously ugly woman that they haven't met before. And they think, well, maybe we should ask her. She may know. So they ask her, and she says, yes, I do know what the answer is that a woman wants most in the world. But she said, I'll only give it to you if you let me marry this handsome young knight here, Sir Gawain. And so Sir Gawain says, I'll gladly marry this hideous woman if she can give us the right answer. And so they make the deal, and the woman whispers the answer into Arthur's ear, and he thinks, oh, that is it. That's the answer. So they continue on and meet the Green Knight. And the Green Knight says, well, what did you find out? What does a woman want most in the world? And Arthur says, she wants sovereignty. And the Green Knight says, that's right. And so Arthur keeps his head, and Sir Gawain has to marry this loathly woman. Sometimes the name of the story is the Loathsome Damsel, or the Loathly Woman, because she's hideous and ugly and smells bad and looks like she's been homeless for about the last 10 years. So they go back to court, and Gawain, and they find out her name. Her name is Dame Ragnell. And so Dame Ragnell and Sir Gawain marry. And on the first night of their marriage, Dame Ragnell is in her room preparing for the evening. And Gawain is preparing the wedding bed for her. And when she comes out, she's the most attractive woman he's ever seen. And he said, who are you? And she says, I'm Dame Ragnell, who you married this afternoon. And he says, but you don't look like her. And she says, no, I don't. She says, I've been under a spell. And half the time I must appear to be hideous and loathly and repulsive. And the other half I can look like myself, which is how you see me now. And she says to him, so you have a choice. You can have me beautiful during the day, and everyone at court will admire me and admire you and think, my, how lucky you are to have such a beautiful wife. But at night, I'll be ugly and hideous to sleep with. Or, she said, you could have me hideous during the day, and people will feel sorry for you, and they'll shun you, and they won't want me around. But at night, I'll be wonderful to sleep with. So what do you want? And Sir Gawain says, well, this really affects you more than me. So what do you want? And as soon as he says that, she lets out this gorgeous smile and says, you've broken the spell. I don't have to be ugly at all anymore. And what broke the spell was sovereignty, that he let her be in charge of her own life. So it's a wonderful story. And the Wife of Bath tale in Chaucer is very similar. And you can find this kind of story in other cultures too. But the wisdom teaching behind this story is that this is what not just women, but everyone wants. They want to be in charge of their own life. They want to make the decisions that most affect them. And by allowing her to have sovereignty, to be sovereign, Sir Gawain, in effect, breaks the spell that she's been living under. So that's the story of Dame Ragnell, and, you know, another little place where it seems to be important, and especially important in a personal way, because Dame Ragnell is not a queen, and she's not married to the king, and it's not about politics or sovereignty in that sense. It's simply about being responsible for yourself and being able to take charge of your own life. In other words, to live with dignity and self-confidence, which is what sovereignty is really about.
I love that story. Sir Gawain and Dame Ragnell and sovereignty. You have another one in your basket of tricks.
Yeah, there's another story. There's several variations on this, and more than just one story. But the basic plot is the same in all of them, and it's about five brothers or three brothers, and they're kind of young men, maybe adolescent, teenage types, and they're the sons of a king or a chieftain, so they're like nobles or princes, and they're out in the wilderness on a very miserable night, camping, so they get a little fire going, and it really is a bad night. The wind is blowing, it's cold and sleeting, and they're huddled around the fire trying to keep warm, when all of a sudden they sense there's someone else kind of coming out of the darkness and stepping into the glow of the fire. And when they look, it turns out to be this fantastically hideous woman, just like in the story of Dame Ragnell. She smells bad, she looks bad, she's loathsome, she's repulsive. She looks like she's been homeless for 10 years or more. And she asks for hospitality. She wants to be able to spend the night there by the fire where it's warmer. And the older brothers all say no to her. They say, no, go on, you know, stay to yourself. You have no right to be here. But, you know, they basically don't want to share it with this loathsome woman. But the youngest brother, it's always the youngest brother in this kind of tale, follows her and before she gets away and says, just don't leave yet. You can come and you can lie by me and I'll keep you warm for the night. So she does. And in some versions of the story, he just embraces her and gives her a goodnight kiss. In some versions of the story, he makes love to her. And in the morning when he wakes up, she's lying there, but like in the Dame Ragnell story, she's the most beautiful woman he's ever seen. And he says, who are you? And she says, well, I'm the woman you gave comfort to last night. And he says, but you don't look like her at all. And she says, but I am. And he says, what's your name? And she says, Sovereignty. And then she disappears. But she sees to it, since she's the goddess of sovereignty, she's the goddess of the land, she sees to it that he becomes the next king rather than his older brothers, or the next chief, whichever the story is about. So here's another tale where sovereignty, you know, wants to be embraced and is a representative of the great mother goddess, the divine feminine, that needs to be embraced and needs to be honored. And it's only a man or a young boy who does that who's really fit to become the next king or the next chief. And, you know, one of the things that people often ask is, well, you know, why is she always so hideous? I mean, why does she have to be ugly in these stories? And there are different answers to this. The ones that I find to be the most insightful is that you're afraid of her. When you see her, your natural reaction is to say, go away, I don't want anything to do with you. There's something scary and fearful about her. And this might be an insight, kind of a psychological insight into sovereignty, in that it is scary to think that you're in charge of your own life, that you have to take responsibility. You can't blame anyone else. You know, it's you. So that initial reaction might be that we're scared. And in some of the stories like this one, where it's about a young boy or a young man, part of that fear might also be the fear of growing up, of becoming an adult and having to take on the responsibilities of adulthood. Or in the case of, you know, the young prince, the story of the fear of having to take on the responsibilities of the kingdom. But once you embrace it, that seems to be the message there, that by embracing it and accepting it and saying, you know, I will love you, that it suddenly becomes beautiful. And sovereignty really is someone who enriches your life and brings beauty into your life. So anyway, the sovereignty.
Yeah, well, I think that's that's a really important part of this, of the whole concept of sovereignty. And this is why I think it sort of transcends duality, because we in these stories we're looking upon the other and we're finding it ugly and uncomfortable and fearsome.
Yeah.
But when we embrace that otherness in spite of our reaction to it, mm-hmm. it ceases to become other.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the message there, that, you know, sovereignty means you have to embrace other people's sovereignty, too, and acknowledge it. And it's not about being selfish or, you know, being lacking concern for anyone else. You have to honor and embrace the sovereignty of others. One definition of sovereignty that I like a lot is that sovereignty supposes that each person has a secret, unknown center or life that others should respect. You know, each of us in some ways is an unknown, as you're saying. It's the other. It can all often be scary or frightening because it's the unknown. But when you stop and think about that each person, the unknown in them is their secret life. It's, you know, it's their center. It's what makes them who they are. It's their heart song. And we need to embrace that and honor that.
Mm. Yeah, we do. And when we do, the loathsomeness of the world disappears.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we get a very different experience of the rough places.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's like when we embrace the land, when we embrace the mother, the creation or whatever, however you want to talk about it, and allow ourselves to receive that which is, as opposed to trying to control and limit that which we receive.
Right.
If we embrace and engage without reservation, without fear,
mm-hmm.
there's something that happens to our own capacity to be sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's like we release tension. We let go of a particular kind of tension that exists between us and the other, which creates the discomfort that causes us the pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, too, part of that tension is you might think of as distortion, that initially in these stories, the other appears to be repulsive, but it's because you're really not seeing who that person is.
Yeah, exactly.
The person is off, and it is like, to use your word, is other. But then as soon as you embrace it, you know, that the distortion goes away and you begin to see, you know, the beauty that this other person has because they too are a human being just like you.
As promised, we're always thinking of ways to bring you a fresh new perspective. Check out this lineup of our newest shows. The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Heisey Lutmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella, on the first and third Tuesday evenings each month. The brand new Embracing Change, The Joy of a New Path, with career coach Ivan Teams and John Carosella, the fourth Tuesday evening of each month. What's Your Prescription for Balance, with Mildred Lynn McDonald and her co-host, Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday afternoon each month. And Evolve, with Robin White Turtle Lisney, the third Thursday afternoon each month. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows, LIVE.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella. I had the good fortune to host Chief Golden Light Eagle, a hereditary tribal chief of the Ehangtuan Dakota Sioux, back in 2011. Since then, Chief has been a precious and delightful presence in my life, full of good humor and wise counsel. In this clip from our May 2012 conversation, I asked the Chief about some of the animal medicine and guidance from his book, The Maka Wikapi Wikohan, or Earth Star Way. Bear and turtle have some important reminders for us.
The bear people asking us to pick up our sacred responsibilities. So every human being, every two-leg on this planet, and everyone has a responsibility to themselves, to their family, to their circles of friends and their extended families, their communities, their towns, their cities, the whole United States, and from there out into internationally and out into the universe. So we all have a responsibility depending on where you want to start and how fast you want to move. So the bear people ask you to pick that up.
And what prevents us from picking it up? Why is it hard?
So a lot of people allow themselves to give power, to give away their power to one little emotion, and it's called fear. So they give power to this little emotion, and because they're afraid of what people are going to say or think or what they're going to do if they open up their hearts and if they do what enlivens their hearts. So that's what stops them. So the bear basically tells everyone to keep all their altars, all their chakra systems open, especially the doorway to your heart.
Well, I know that I feel fear. I feel fear of failure in attempting to walk my path.
Failure is an illusion. Failure was taught to you to create control mechanisms, you know, that you surrender yourself to. So there's no such thing. When the spirit sees you, you just create an extension of what you want to fulfill. And whether you do it on this lifetime, and if it's, you could extend it to the next lifetime, to the next, so it's ongoing. There's no such thing as failure.
Well, that's an interesting way of allowing yourself to sidestep fear, or having an ability to set fear aside, so that you can proceed and to say, failure doesn't actually register on the spiritual scale.
Because you
always have another, there's always more. There's always more. Mm-hmm. There's always more time, if not in this life, then the next, kind of thing.
Right.
And that is actually kind of comforting. And it also kind of takes the pressure off.
Yeah.
So that's great. I would like to ask you about one more, and that is the universal law of life, the straight path.
The Unchikia, the grandmother turtle, is the messenger for that law. So the turtle reminds us to move very, very slowly upon Mother Earth, you know, because that's the way she is. She works from every step that she takes on Mother Earth, she says is a step of love, that you should take it very gently. And never speed along. There's no reason for that. To walk very gently and very, very slow on Mother Earth.
Well, we have a propensity in Western culture to not move slowly. We feel like we are in a race to accomplish, to mm-hmm. achieve, to engage, to master. Why is that not an important thing? I mean, you know, in the end, right? I mean, I guess that's the root question is, walking slowly means doing less, or does it?
Walking slowly helps you to understand why you're walking.
that is great right there. For all of you who are listening, I'm going to remember that for a very long time. Walking slowly helps you remember why you're walking. That is.
Yeah, we got to honor that walk, because it took like us 2,000 years just to think about how we can stand up. to just to conceive that thought and create our muscles and everything else that to move into a position to stand upright. So we have to just take the walking as a blessing of that. So the path is walked upright.
That it took us so long to reach the moment of this moment.
Right.
Should compel us, should encourage us to take the time to understand how we got here, that we got here, and why we're here, rather than to just be in a hurry to move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's really beautiful. And that's and simple and obvious.
Yeah. So the turtles, they remind us that we have a shell, you know, around us as well. And when we are in our moments of difficulty and chaos and turmoils, then that's the time that we go into our shell. And our shell represents our ceremony and represents our dance, represents our sweat lodge, our meditation, or you know, singing, or doing artwork, or doing anything that enlivens your heart is your shell. And then when you're finished with that, then you're able to share your experience and your happiness and the things that made you feel so good about yourself with other people, and you could teach them that walk. So
there's great power in the protection, right? The shell
right.
is a, mm-hmm. is protection, but it's protection based on power of that comes to us from spirit, I guess.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So the turtles works with that and asks us to use them ways of enlightenment, and we need to use them ways of enlightenment by looking and listening to the children, because they're just naturals. You know, they're not heavy. They don't have no problems mm-hmm. whatsoever. They don't know what it means to have a problem. So they just go with their heart and their feeling. They run. They, you know, they do everything until we tell them, and we mess them up by saying, "Don't do that. It's wrong." You know,
yeah.
And they don't know what wrong means. So we have to learn and watch the children as they play, as they do things, because it's part of our growth as well to learn from the children. They're our teachers.
Yeah, they're our teachers.
Yeah. So we're working with this this grandmother's ways, and she works with these ways of this silence, you know. She works with the oceans, so the cosmic oceans. She works with the heart, you know, a creator, you could say. So there's moments when you'll understand all that. There's a lot of things that we don't understand until we go through the situation, you know, we experience. So we have to learn those corridors of experience that the turtle wants us to learn, and that's working with the silence. She's very silent.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella. Daniel Four and I met back in 2011 when we hosted an Orisha elder for a weekend workshop back when we had the Firefly Willows Healing Arts Center. It took me until January of 2013 to connect with him again. In this clip from our January conversation, Daniel talks about ways of uncovering the essential self.
One of the, if you look even at like Tibetan Buddhist tantric practice, there's a whole cycle of mother tantra and father tantra that precedes the non-dual tantric work. And the implication of that, as I understand it, I'm not a teacher of that tradition, is that one needs to really have activated those two sides of the psyche in order to have the child of our authentic self, of our unique self, be born. In a more shamanic vocabulary, for me, I see developmentally a need for us to relate well with the earth, what's below, with the stars, with the heavens, with the cosmic forces, and with humanity. And the human as a mode of consciousness is a child of heaven and earth, of Mother Earth and Father Sky. And so the work is to relate well with the land, with the plants, animals, powers, elements, where we're at, all the forces of nature, to relate well with the transcendent, with the deity, with the many energies that are underlying what we're made of, and to remember our destiny in that way, and to bring that together in our unique human mode of consciousness so we're not annoying too much to other people, so we know how to love other people and take in their love. We know how to be ethical, be sensible, pay our bills, vote even, and how to navigate human consciousness. And so...
And this comes simply from knowing oneself.
Well, if the self is at the center of the circle, the way to know what's at the center of the circle is not to sit at the center of the circle. You need to go all over the place and expand how the circumference of it, and to see, you can't know yourself fully without knowing the stars or the weird Dumbo octopus at the bottom of the ocean, or knowing how to forgive your father, or how to pay your bills, and how to navigate all these different demands from different domains of reality, all of which are sacred, some of which we like, some of which we dislike, but they're all part of what we are. There's nothing outside the self. There's nothing foreign to the self. And so whatever you think is not you points to something that you haven't yet recognized as part of you. Yeah,
because whatever is out there is in some form or fashion interacting with you and asking for some kind of conscious response.
It's part of the story. Not all the relatives, not all the different kinds of people are friendly. Some wish to kill us and, you know, revel in the energy of fear and death. And you don't want to invite those energies into your home, but they're your relative. They're still part of our extended family. And so I frame the question of knowing oneself more as knowing your place, knowing your role, knowing your particular unique work and song and trajectory in the larger web of beings.
And that exercise of discovering your song is not an exercise you do alone.
Correct.
Correct.
That's part of the reality check. Sometimes people think that there's a lot of wounded people in spiritual circles, and I used to be more so one of those people. And one of the things that will happen is people believe that they have discovered themselves, and they may genuinely be tapping into a really expanded type of consciousness, but the response back is, who cares a little bit if you're not showing up well, if you can't ground it in a way that brings love and benefit and beauty into other people's lives, then it's not of benefit, I guess. And so the reality check on whether or not our self-knowledge has become useful is others and other beings, and whether or not you bring happiness to others through how you show up. Yeah,
that's very, it's very sweetly profound, that knowing oneself both compels and requires the interaction with the world.
Yeah, the ethic that I've encountered that to me is the most I don't know, it sounds snobby when I say evolved, but I'll own my judgment there. So the most evolved articulation of a human potential that I've encountered is the Bodhisattva teachings in Mahayana Buddhism, so Zen, Tibetan, other lineages of Buddhism. And as I understand it, in a nutshell, the Bodhisattva vow and ideal that one aspires to embody is an ethic of profound non-abandonment. Basically says that I will return again and again and again to birth, presumably human birth, but maybe not, could be any different form, in order to just be with all the beings who are still suffering and may not know themselves yet and may need a companion and may need care. And I'm not running away. Spirituality is not about getting out of here. It's about mustering the courage to never abandon another being and to keep showing up again and again and again and again. And as I understand it, you can arrive at that ideal two general ways. One is through great love and compassion, and that says, like, why would I possibly want to leave my child? And if every being is my child and my mother, I'm not going to do that. I commit to being here. Like, and another way of arriving at it is through getting theologically, religiously just checkmated around the idea that you can have individual enlightenment, that you, John, or I could be enlightened while other beings are suffering. It implies that there's some fundamental separation between you and others.
Which is an illusion.
And if that's an illusion, if you really examine it and you're like, man, I haven't found a way to substantiate that I'm totally separable from other beings, then individual enlightenment is like the left hand is saying it's happy while the right hand is bleeding, and there's it doesn't make any sense to pursue. It's suddenly individual enlightenment looks like cowardice. It looks like running, unless it's motivated by a desire to become more effective at helping others.
Right.
And so there's a. And there's a thing that, for me, that's very instructive. It's like, don't run away. Come back, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Fall in love with the world and other beings, and then ask, how can you help them?
Help? Yeah. Yeah, how can I help?
Yeah, what's needed?
You want to know yourself? Ask how you can help.
Yeah, like that. Exactly. Yeah, what's my place? Well, I'm not sure what my place is. Well, what's needed? That's a good start.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Hi, this is John Carosella, your host for Convergence on Firefly Willows LIVE. I truly enjoy putting this show together for you. It's an honor and a blessing to share what I learned from my guests, co-hosts, and personal travels. If you'd like to help, contributions in any amount are gratefully received. Send a contribution via PayPal to convergence@fireflywillows.com. Your support means a lot to me. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Welcome back. I'm John Carosella. Here's another Exploring Reality segment, this time about the subtle magic and responsibility that comes with breathing. Over the past year or so, I've been learning a lot and experiencing a lot about breathing. It dawned on me that breathing is an extraordinarily intimate act. Think about it. When you breathe, you take in random air molecules from all around you, through your nose, down your throat, and into your lungs, where they mingle with your insides. Indeed, they become part of you. And we do this constantly. It never stops. When you exhale, you push what was, just seconds ago, part of your very blood out into the world. So ethereal, this breathing thing, and yet so very, very messy and sanguinary. We allow our blood to touch the world in every breath. It's pretty spectacular when you think about it. I'll also admit that it can also seem a little gross and more than a little terrifying when you think about it this way. But that's what makes it fascinating and what compels me to
explore this very fundamental intimacy. So I want to go a little bit deeper. It's not just any old air molecule that enters your body. It's an air molecule that has been profoundly affected by the environment in which it is floating. It's been zapped by cosmic rays, perhaps. Most certainly by a cell phone signal or two. It's vibrating with the heat reflected off the pavement, or the trees, or the foreheads of the people in the room. Each molecule we bring into such intimate contact with our inner physical being is a quiver with the energies present all around us, and, to greater or lesser degrees, all the energy that is radiating at all the frequencies from all directions. Poor little molecule, so profoundly bopped and bonked and spun about, and then in it goes. What happens when it gets there? Of course, it carries all those vibrations with it, right into the inner sanctum of the physical. Makes you long for some good, clean, natural, fresh air, doesn't it? The other side is just as interesting. When we exhale, the molecules we release carry with them the vibrations that are inside of us. So all the frequencies that are generated by the complex interactions of our functioning selves are present in each exhalation. It's interesting to think about what makes up those vibrations. Our physical state, to be sure, but also all the rest of us. Our moods, our thoughts, our dreams, our pettiness and our valor, all present in every exhalation. Perhaps the instantaneous energy signature of all of that is what our soul looks like in that very moment. Are we exhaling our soul profile written in the energy signature of our breath? If so, what we are inside ourselves fundamentally impacts the world outside of ourselves. And what is outside affects what we are becoming. What are you inhaling? Perhaps more importantly, what are you exhaling? The mystical traditions place great power in the breath. The power to create, destroy, rebalance, cleanse, heal, the list goes on and on. With this perspective, I have to agree. And recently, I've begun to experience this power directly. As I explore the crossover between deep physics, spirituality, and healing, and in particular, as I continue to study yoga and qigong, I sense and can sometimes manipulate the power of breath, this intimate, deep, essential power that we engage in all day without ceasing. It's very, very cool. We can argue over the magnitude of the impact, for sure. Perhaps someday we'll understand how to measure it all. I'll be excited when that happens, but also a little sad that the mystery is solved. Until then, I continue to explore and have no doubt that the breath has a powerful and intimate capacity to connect us to the world and the world to us. We'll be right back.
A personal tarot reading can offer you insight, information, enlightenment, and empowerment along your life's path. Hi C is a professional tarot conversationalist and ritualist with over 10 years' experience. He's available for readings in a variety of formats, including parties and events. To schedule your personal tarot reading, contact Hi C at tarotbyhic.net or email him at hic@fireflywillows.com.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella. Annette Wagner is a dear friend and colleague. We've been helping each other walk the talk and be the change since we met a few years back.
Here's a clip from our conversation last August. I'm trying to understand the purpose of play. Annette, as a creativity coach, knows a lot about play and what it's good for. With me this morning is Annette Wagner. Annette is a visionary artist, creativity teacher, and coach. Creativity is her passion, and I am hoping to have a conversation with Annette about play and about creativity. So, given that I'm not exactly the best player, I seem to have dropped a gene or it's gone dormant or something, I am going to ask Annette to help me and help you find your way into the roots of play. So, welcome, Annette.
Thank you, John. I'm very happy to be here today.
It's going to be fun, right?
It will be fun and creative.
All right. So one of the things that seems to be a challenge for me is to find myself in the place of play, to deliberately move myself into the place of play. And I imagine that that's something that, given the work you do, that you have to do. So how do you do that? How do you get your clients into the place of play?
So there are many techniques I use. The most important one is to recognize where people are coming from in the culture that we live in today. And as you said, I love the comment that you made about you think maybe you don't have a gene, because I hear from so many people out there that they don't have a creative bone in their body.
Mm.
And it's a very common complaint, but the reality is that's simply not true.
Maybe it's like the gene is not turned on.
Well, and I think actually what happens is in childhood is we are very much connected to this gene, and there's things that happen, whether it's how you're raised or the experiences that you've had, that teach us to turn or tune down or disconnect from the channel that connects us to our innate creativity. Because every human being is creative. That's how we move through life. We couldn't actually function in life if we didn't have some level of creativity moving us forward. But the way that connection, forms or is present when we're adults is many times not a full open channel. And that's where I work with people to move them into that. And part of what I do is I create containers for opportunity. I literally, both physically, emotionally, spiritually, you name it, I think about when I'm working with someone, what kind of container needs to be created that I can then take that person and move them into a place where they can connect with that innate creativity inside of themselves and let it come out so that they can play.
Okay, so I want to, there's two directions I want to go at once. First is you talk about creativity,
mm-hmm.
but I talked about play. So I want to understand, are they the same thing? And if they're not the same thing, how do they relate to one another? Because I feel like I can be creative often,
mm-hmm.
but I don't feel like I'm playing often. And maybe I'm just not seeing something about the nature of creativity and play.
The way I view what you're talking about is creativity is the innate energy we have inside of ourselves to create from ourselves. Play happens when you are in connection with that creativity. And you're in connection with the creativity, the channel is open, and there's an element of trust that comes in when you're in connection with that creativity. Trust that you can be creative, trust that it's okay to be creative, trust that whatever's going to happen is perfectly fine. That trust isn't always present when we connect to our creativity in sort of, I will say, today's culture as a way of saying, like wherever we're at, what I find for many people is where they're at right now in their life, they've constrained the channel of creativity. So to me, creativity and play are inherently and directly connected. When you have a full operational channel into your innate creativity and you trust what's going to come out of that and your intuition and your right brain and your left brain are completely working together in that, play just naturally happens.
Well, that's very interesting. Okay, so this is actually really helpful. There's an aspect of creativity that it can be present in the absence of play.
Mm-hmm.
But in trusting that the output of the creative process is going to be okay, that opens the channel to play?
Yes. So many times I have had clients and students who've come to me and told me about an experience when they were a child, and I've had one of these myself. And you may have or may not, but many people have had an experience when they were a child where someone criticized or invalidated or told them what they were doing was stupid or ugly or not worth it. I remember painting a picture of a California poppy and having a teacher who I didn't get along with who came by and just made this comment that completely invalidated all the efforts I put into this piece of artwork. And I thought I'd actually done a pretty darn good job of drawing. It was in fourth grade, and I drew a California poppy, because that's what you do with California history, you know, when you're in fourth grade. And I never drew it. I didn't draw another flower for several years. And I've heard that story mirrored so many times. But yet I continue to be creative. I have 21 patents. I worked in high tech for many years. I'm a highly creative person. But I constrained the channel. And there were areas I wouldn't go because I had gotten this message somehow that what I was creating was not good enough. And I closed the channel down. It never entirely goes away. And that's something that I very much believe it. It never entirely goes away.
So I want to just spend a little bit more time on this connection between creativity and play, because I feel like there's something important that I want to soak in for another minute so I can really understand it. The channel of creativity never goes away.
No.
But play can go away.
Yes. Our enjoyment of, how to say, the joy that creating can bring us. Creativity is essential to who we are as human beings. It's essential to how we move through life. It's essential to happiness and joy. But what happens is we shut the channel down enough that it doesn't sustain us. It doesn't bring us joy. What inspiration it brings, we don't recognize. We don't acknowledge. And yet we can still access it because we have to. In order to live our lives, we have to have some ability to access it. But we shut it down to a point where it no longer is sustaining us in the way that it really could. It's not bringing us joy. It's not bringing us inspiration. Or we're not recognizing
it. So what happens? Why do those things matter? I know that seems like an odd question, but in terms of being a fully realized, fully accessing and exercising your gifts, why does play matter? Why does creativity matter? And why does the channel being open enough to identify and appreciate the joy and fulfillment that comes from it matter?
So I talk about the joy and the inspiration and the other things that it brings you. But the reason it really matters is because it makes us whole people. This is where I talk a little bit about right brain and left brain. In the culture, in Western culture today, we are a highly analytical culture that operates from the mind. Yet, if we were going to go out and invent a mouse or invent an iPad or invent something else out in high tech, inherently, our intuitive side comes into play because that's where invention comes from. That's where inspiration comes from. That's where the connections are made that then the mind can go off and implement in order to create the really cool thing that we're going to ship as a product. They have to both be present, but when we do not acknowledge that intuitive, inventive, inspirational side, we're not living to our full capacity as humans. We're not taking advantage of all we can truly be as people.
So something dawns on me. You talk about the joy and the fulfillment and stuff like that. And it's maybe that it's the experience of wholeness that actually creates the joy.
Yes.
It's not the joy. The joy is not the goal.
The joy is the reward for being living.
The joy is the reward for being whole.
Yes.
That's totally cool.
Thank you.
That's a really cool observation and a really cool and important kind of awareness that it's joy. Joy is an artifact of wholeness. It's not a goal in and of itself.
No, it's something that tells you that you're
approaching wholeness.
Well, or that you're in a state where I sometimes see wholeness as something. See, I don't subscribe to the theory that we live to goals.
Mm-hmm.
I subscribe to a theory that I walk a path. And there are times I am more whole and times I come apart and times I come back together because we are always moving through the cycle of life and through transformation. there is always something birthing, something dying, something regenerating and rotting and composting and coming back to life. And that's the piece of the cycle of life that people do not in our culture understand or embrace many times. Yet that's the place where things come from. That's where things manifest from. That's where things grow from.
I have to tell you, Annette, I almost can't even listen right now because of the profundity of what you just led me to. I am so happy to have had you here sharing this information with me because it is a huge revelation to me.
And here you thought that you didn't have a gene that would allow you to do these things.
Because I was looking at it the wrong way.
See, was it a wrong way?
Well, it's the pursuit of play.
Mm-hmm.
The pursuit of that thing that apparently I'm not so good at.
I don't know about if you are or you aren't, John.
Well, no, and of course I don't. It's allegedly, right? Let's just say it that way. Turns out it's the wrong goal.
Well, does it need to be a goal or is it a state of being?
Well, okay, either way, from where I am to, you know, like how do you bring people to the place of play? You know, reflecting back on that earlier question, it's for me as the metaphysicist kind of guy, the guy who's trying to sort all this stuff out and place it in its relevant context and in its right relation to everything else. What I just learned was that it isn't about play. It's about wholeness, and play is correlated closely to the experience of wholeness, and the joy that you get from play is an indication of the experience of wholeness. And so it's nurturing wholeness, really. What I was trying to figure out was, how do you nurture play and why does it matter, right? And I think that the key is that play doesn't matter on its own. It's an indication and an exercise in experiencing wholeness, which really matters. So, and now this is all for me, right? I mean,
right.
This is my context, which is, you know, trying to fit all this together and find purpose in and value in play. And now I know.
Let me add another little piece into the mix. One of the reasons it's so critical to integrate play and open that channel of creativity so fully is it brings all the parts of us together into this wholeness, right? There's something else that happens when that integration takes place, is there is a switching of things inside of you that's going to happen, which is instead of the mind leading, the heart will begin to lead, and the mind will step into a more appropriate and balanced relationship with the heart, whereas the mind supports the heart. This is a much more organic way of living. It is not an analytical or a logical way of living. And so for when you, and I know people, I've coached through this and I've moved through this, is when you do this, it will actually move you to a place where you almost feel like you're starting to go crazy because you start to live a life where things do not operate or happen in the same kind of time flow that we're logically used to.
What does that mean? No, they don't happen in the same kind of time flow.
So for example, sometimes I'll paint a painting and I don't know where the image is coming from. And 3 weeks later, something will happen in my life and I'll go, oh, it was opening the doorway for that to happen. Or something will happen and I'll paint a painting and things, or I'll have a conversation with someone like you and things will happen that seem like they're not in sequence, but they're all very much more connected. And they're in fact more important in the way they're connected.
Then you would have perhaps deliberately tried to craft.
Right. You could never have crafted something like that. A pattern, it's like a pattern that falls into place in your life and it doesn't happen logically. It happens like pieces of a weaving kind of coming into focus.
Yeah.
And then when they come together, it's like this whole new pattern is in your life and it's a very different way of living. And you'll find yourself lessening the grasp that you have on living your life by a clock.
Yes, we've added to our lineup of lively, thought-provoking shows. But don't forget our original Sunday morning lineup at 10:30 a.m. Join us for Healing Conversations with Mildred Lynn McDonald every first Sunday. Revolution with Heisey Lutmers every second Sunday. Convergence with John Carosella every third Sunday, and our popular on-air call-in show the fourth Sunday of every month. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows LIVE.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella. Finally today, another poem. This time by musician and performance artist Maya Apollonia Rode. We opened today's show with a poem about God within us. We'll close with another perspective on the same topic. Maya Apollonia Rode. It's entitled The Sculptor and the Stone.
One day a sculptor, all alone, took a chisel to a stone, and with one movement of her hand, a world of time and space began. She chiseled here and chiseled there, and soon a universe appeared. She gave it color, she gave it sound, she gave it up and gave it down. She gave it hills and gave it trees. She gave it stars and galaxies. She gave it creatures of all sizes and all sorts of fun surprises, like eyes and ears and hands and feet, like soft and warm and cold and heat, like earth and water, air and fire. She gave and gave and did not tire. And then she gave it you and me and all things through eternity. And she rejoiced, for she was glad to give it everything she had. Yet, there was something still to give. The one thing that could make it live. And in the moment that she knew it, she breathed all of herself into it. Some say the sculptor is no more. There's nowhere you can find her. Others say she's everywhere and nothing is behind her. You'll find opinions everywhere, but the answer's in your heart. You've always known the sculptor of this living work of art. And some would say through speculation, she disappeared in her creation. Still, others see, and so can you, perceive directly what is true, that everything, in whole or part, is itself the sculptor's heart. In every inch and every mile, every frown and every smile, in every shape and every sound, that's where the sculptor can be found. In all the feelings, all the sights, throughout your days and darkest nights. In everyone of every race, you behold the sculptor's face. And when they all look back at you, they behold the sculptor too. You are the hills, the stars, the trees, and endless possibilities, like birds that fly, and fish that swim, and oceans that they swim. swim within. Just look, and you will see it's true. Everything's announcing you. Listen. You can hear the call of it. Echoing. Echoing. You are all of it.
Well, that's our show. I'm off for the month of August, but don't worry, we'll have a show from the archives to share next month. And we'll be back with fresh content in September. Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for our live on-air call-in show, Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m.